Our next guest is a former mayor of Bangor, a member of the United States House of Representatives, a United States Senator, Defense Secretary, author, and poet, William Cohen, joining us here on Downtown this afternoon. Well, thanks for checking in with us. How are you?
Actually, quite good. Everything is it's been good so far, as we say, but things are improving, I think, now that the elections are finally over for this year.
Well, I want to go back in time 50 years because I was reading in Downey's Magazine, the wonderful excerpt of new book that's out, Bill Cohen's 1972 Campaign for Congress, an Oral History, edited by your friend Christian Potholm. And it was a simpler time 50 years ago when a young man from Bangor, Maine, could set out on foot and make that be not just an effective campaign tool, but an incredibly successful way to learn about the area that you would be representing.
Yeah, it was. And frankly, I had no intention of going back that far in my life. But I got a call from the publisher, who happens to be Jed Lyons, who was a Bowdoin student and one of Chris Potholm's students at Bowdoin. And so when I finally decided to run for office, I had really no staff, no help, and I called Chris Potholm, who was a classmate of mine and a dear friend, and I said, "I need your help." And so he reluctantly, I think, he said he didn't know what he was getting into either, but he got a few Bowdoin students, and Jed Lyons happened to be one of them, who's now become publisher of one of the great publishing, mid-level publishing companies in the country. And they said, "Let's go back and try to recapture what it was like then." And I was thinking recently about the movie 3 Days of the Condor.
Oh, yes.
Which was based actually on a book, a novel, 6 Days of the Condor. But there's a wonderful line in the film in which the young intelligence officer turns to an older member of the OSS, which is the predecessor to the CIA. And the younger man says, "Do you miss the good old days?" And the OSS officer, former OSS officer, said, "No, but I do miss the clarity of it all." And it sort of sums up how I look back now and see what's taking place today. And it was so much simpler, so much clearer, I think, in terms of the parties, the issues involved, the fact that we didn't have social media, which can be helpful and harmful at the same time. And so I think it was a better time for political discourse, that there was less cruelty, crudity, hate language, and hate action in those days. And I think that we have evolved, or devolved, I guess would be a better way of saying it, to a place where it's harder for people to run for office and do so in a way that responds to our the angels of you know, our nature, the best angels, and that quality of which we're looking at public servants as being fiduciaries. And that's kind of a legal phraseology, but a fiduciary has a higher standard of conduct than an ordinary citizen, because you're asking for the public to trust you. And in order to deserve that trust, you have to set a higher standard of conduct and of speech. And I think we have seen that degrade over time. And I was lucky enough to serve at a time when you had people like Ed Muskie, who was our senator and then became a presidential candidate for a period of time, but one of the most respected men in the country. And of course, Margaret Chase Smith, and then you had George Mitchell, Olympia, Snow, and now Susan. But going back in those times, I think that people felt better about the government. You know, we live in a democracy. You always kind of have a level of discontent because you want things to get better for more people. And when that doesn't happen, there's a level of discontent. But you look around and say, this is still the best country, the greatest country in the world, if you look at our system and you look what we've been able to achieve during a short life, historically speaking, a very short life. So I hope that we can learn from the excesses of what we see today, where people feel they have to base their candidacy or their conduct on the lowest common denominator in terms of getting more visibility in the media, becoming more celebrityhoods, celebrities, period, in their own right. So I hope that we'll learn from the excesses of today and evolve toward a almost kind of return to some of the standards of the past.
Well, and I think back to those years in your first term as a member of the House Judiciary Committee, standing up to what was going on with President Richard Nixon, people in the Senate like Howard Baker, and there were no shortage of elected officials who put country before party, and it seems like we don't see as much of that anymore.
No, we don't, and that's the problem today, where the parties, whether drifting to the right or to the left, are making it a litmus test that you can show no independence. And so you have members on the Republican side, for the most part, being in lockstep with former President Trump. And as a result of that, we saw last night even that Senator Warnock was able to win again in Georgia, a reportedly red state now evolving to a purple state and maybe even a blue state. But I think for the most part, the election was conducted at a higher level, notwithstanding the social media coverage of it. But I think Herschel Walker, whom I admired greatly as a football player, but felt he was really not qualified to be a United States Senator, not for me to say, people of Georgia obviously to say, but when you look at the quality of the people who are coming in terms of what they are running on, when you get a Dr. Oz, let's say in Pennsylvania, or a Mastriano, and you see what they're saying, election denying, undermining support for the political process, which we have, which is very damaging, not only to us as a country, but to the perception of us, which is really important, because other nations look at what is happening here as we try to hold up that, the Statue of Liberty, the flame, saying this is how great you can become if you allow people to be free and tap into their creative aspects of their souls and to be innovative, etc. Being free gives you great opportunity, and when you're suppressed or when you're under the oppression of a single leader with an autocratic ruler or dictatorial ruler, then people are not allowed to be as good or great as they can be. So we've always been that symbol, and I think that symbol had deteriorated somewhat. The flame was not quite as bright when they saw what happened on January 6th with people storming the Capitol, roaming through the Capitol, really despoiling the United States Capitol at that time. That had a big impact on our allies, saying, if that can happen in America, why should we allow in our own countries what you're doing, to give that much freedom to people and to see it turned against you? It had a major impact in terms of people admiring us. And when people start admiring you, they start following your lead. And, you know, we have been a leader of the free world, and we want to continue to lead the free world, what we think in terms of the arc of history, bending towards justice, towards freedom, toward individual creativity and opportunity. You know, we have to think about ourselves, obviously, in terms of how do we get by day to day, how do people pay their bills, what we do about inflation. But when we see our own system being undermined from within, and that is the greatest threat we face right now, certainly on a physical, violent level, the security systems, Homeland Security, FBI, and others have indicated that homegrown extremism is the greatest threat we face today.
We're talking with Secretary William Cohen here on Downtown. How did we get here? And obviously there are a lot of reasons for us reaching this point in our politics and our nation, but I'm curious about a couple areas. How much of a role do the campaign finance laws play, which I think lead people to play to the extremes, and then the nominating process within each party that tends to be either more liberal or more conservative than the electorate?
Well, you, a number of factors. You can point to money, which at the root of all evil, as Vail wants to say, but money has become fundamental to the political process in a way that I think is dangerous. I grew very disenchanted during my years as I started out 50 years ago, and I thought it was pretty expensive then, that it was hard to raise enough money within a state to run a campaign given the costs of television at that stage. But it's grown so exponentially that members of the Congress, certainly, and members of the Senate, they work through Thursday evening and then get on a plane, and they take the weekend, some with their families, but most of them on the money run. And they are on a plane going to various cities around the country to raise money to fund their next campaign. So they leave on Thursday night, they're gone Friday, Saturday, Sunday, come back Monday, and then try to legislate Tuesday, Wednesday, and half of Thursday. And it just becomes exhausting. It also requires you to be beholden to so many different interest groups it makes it almost impossible for people to be doing their jobs while focusing on how much money they're bringing in on the revenue raising.
And I wonder, too, when you had members of Congress spending the weekend in Washington and not coming home to do that money run, as you put it, did that also give them more of a chance to socialize and get to know each other as people? So while you might disagree on issues, you don't disrespect them as individuals.
That is also part of it, Rich, as well, that we've seen parties treat each other as enemies, where in the good old days, we had a rule in the Senate, by way of example, that we never went into another senator's state to campaign for their opponent. Mm. That's just fundamental, human relations 101. The Senate you have a six-year term. You have to work and work at a consensus. So you have to build friendships on both sides of the aisle, so to speak. And if you go into a state and campaign for an opponent of the current senator, he's not going to be as eager to work with you when you get back into session.
Right.
It was just a fundamental rule, never do that. The only one who ever breached it was Teddy Kennedy for me. and he would come in and just do a light campaign for whoever the Democratic candidate was. And we used to joke because he was a good friend. And I said, Teddy, every time you come into my state, my ratings go up. and we'd have a big laugh about that. But he was the only one, and it was not really pushing the issue. He did it as a favor of the Democratic Party. But it was never on an attack against me or any Republican. It was always for the benefit of the Democratic Party. But that was just kind of an unwritten rule that we had at that time. It was just, again, how do you get along and make friends? And we had a rule that even in the House, saying, look, the House is much more partisan, has been historically, than the Senate. In the House, the shortest distance between two points is a congressional term. The House is designed to keep you very close to the people you represent. The Senate used to be designed to say, well, in the Senate you get a little more leeway. You can be a statesman for 4 years, and then you can be, a politician for two, and get back and campaign on the issues. But at least that six-year period gave you some break in terms of having to come home every weekend. And I know that I did that almost when I was in the House. I was home, I think, 48 out of 52 weekends. That takes a toll, because my family, I had moved down here with the hopes that I could spend more time with them. But then I had to go back to the state and do all the campaigning when I was in the House. The Senate gave me a little more leeway that I could miss one or two weekends and stay in Washington, have what you mentioned before, be able to socialize with Republicans and Democrats. I made it a point to George Mitchell and I wrote a book together We had different points of view and different votes, but we were able to write a book together about the Iran-Contra.
And you wrote together with Gary Hart.
I wrote a novel with Gary Hart, and it came about accidentally. I didn't know him well, but there was a three-day filibuster taking place, and I think it was, back in 1980, as I recall. And I was on the Senate floor at 3 o'clock in the morning. There was no one else on the floor but Gary Hart. I didn't know him particularly well. And everybody else was on sleeping cots outside the chambers. They had set up cots for people to sleep on so they could be called in for a vote if one was going to take place. In any event, I spotted Senator Hart, and I said, I am bone tired. Why don't we go down to the Senate dining room and get some coffee? And so we did. We were the only two in the Senate dining room, and we had a big pot of coffee, and we started to pour it. And I said to Gary, I said, this is crazy what we're doing. Why are we in these all-day sessions and night sessions, and there's no vote? We're just here. And I said, what would you rather be doing if you weren't in the Senate right now? And he said, I'd rather be in Ireland writing a novel. And I said, well, I'm half Irish. I've always wanted to write a novel, so why don't we just do one together? And believe it or not, we sat there and were joking as we were pouring coffee during that time. And he had an envelope, and he said, well, what will we write about? Well, we write about what we know. In other words, we weren't about to start the Gone with the Wind type of novel, but what do we know? I had just come back from a conference on terrorism in Germany because a banker named Schleyer had been assassinated by a right-wing group. And so they had a conference in Berlin, and I went to that conference, and I came back. I said, well, I've learned something about what they're doing in Germany, what the threat is, so why don't we put that as one of our key issues? And he said, well, I served on the church committee investigating the assassination of John Kennedy. We've got to put that in, too. So we made a list of things in about a 40-minute period and wrote a little outline in terms of how those issues would be involved in the story. And I went home that morning to take a shower. So I came back, and I still had the outline in my hand. I called an agent in New York who had represented me on a couple of prior books, and nonfiction poetry, actually. And I said, you've always wanted me to write a novel. I have a friend. I won't tell you who it is, but I have an idea, and a friend of mine could write a pretty good novel. And he said, well, when do you want to see me? I said, today. And so he came down that day. I introduced him to Gary Hart, and I said, here's the story. And he said, it's a terrific story. He said, I like it a lot. And I said, one condition, you can't tell any publisher who we are. He said, well, that's a killer. I said, they're not going to be able to publish anything from people they don't know. And I said, no, it has to be done on the merits. The story has to sell itself. And so he said, I can't sell this novel. He went back. Next day, at 8:24 or 5 in the morning, he called me and said, I just sold your novel. And we signed a contract as Mr. X and Y.
Wow.
And the publisher didn't know who we were until we actually submitted the novel. And it became a pretty big seller.
Yeah.
But those were the days when something like that was possible. And it's very hard today to get that kind of collaboration because, number one, the thing you pointed out, we're traveling all the time. We're traveling to raise money. We're traveling back home to see our families if they're back home. But it's become a 24/7 job. And that's one issue. The second issue is gerrymandering. Now, what's happening today, because the districts are being drawn by both parties when they can, they're being drawn in a way that solidifies their opportunity to have a majority in that district. And so what you're seeing is Republicans can get elected if they go further to the right than the incumbent. And so it's a race to the right. Democrats are doing the same on the left. So as a result of that, you have people planting their flagpoles in the end zones. And I've always talked about politics in the United States as being fought between the 40-yard lines of a football field.
Mm.
This country is, I think, slightly right of center. As historically, I think we're there, or slightly left of center. But when you move away from those 40-yard lines back toward your end zone, you get stagnation, paralysis. And what happens as a result of that, and you can look to see what's going to happen in the next 2 years, unlikely to see much progress on any big issues, simply because you have a House now with one party, a Senate with the other, and the elements within each party pulling to the right and to the left. What happens under those circumstances is that it gives the executive, the president, more power, because no one wants to see stagnation. People need to get paychecks. They need to have government stay open, etc. So the person who has the power to do that in extreme circumstances is the president of the United States. So it's almost a transfer of power to the president and making a stronger executive as opposed to a weaker one, which the constitutional founders wanted to see. And that power divided to make sure that you didn't have such a strong executive, that you had something akin, you know, to the royal power in England. So it there are a lot of reasons why we are polarized, and I could go on at length at least to identify one in which I think that we have failed to take into account as we rush to take advantage of globalization, that we really forgot about the people whose jobs were being lost. And so as a result of that, if you look around the country, you say, well, wait a minute, those jobs that were good for American corporations to take advantage of, let's say, Chinese low-cost labor or no regulation labor, so that we could invest in the big market over there and get cheaper goods so that people could buy goods at a lower price here. But it cost a lot of jobs in the industrial sector of this country. And I don't think we, and I put myself in that category as well, we didn't think far enough ahead to say, what is the cost going to be to our industrial base here, to the people who use their hands and manual labor and the manufacturing process, which is still in the position of the process of evolving. And we took advantage of low-cost and low-wage countries. And so we're paying a price for that now, because people in the Midwest, the former industrial states, mostly white, middle class, not part of the college or higher education population, they're saying, hey, you forgot about us. And I think that's part of it. There's anger there. Mm.
Is that what fuels that frustration and what seems like, in some quarters, the willing embrace of authoritarianism as long as that authoritarian figure will provide you with some measure of protection?
Exactly right. And that's where, I think we have failed to take into account what we were doing. Short term, great. We did a lot of good things for a lot of people throughout the world, and it's important to for our companies to be able to say we're helping to raise the wages and the living standards of people in other countries, because it's an opportunity for us to sell goods to emerging markets. If you look at where the population growth is, well, it is in China. It was in China, although long term it's diminishing. India, 1.3 to 4 billion people, big market. Africa is going to be one of the really exploding populations in the world. So is it important to help them modernize so they can become consumers of American products? The answer is yes. So we've helped people all across the globe to come out of poverty, massive poverty. But at the same time, we have to make sure that, you know, our first obligation is right here. And we have to make sure that we provide a basic source of income for all Americans. And I think we've failed in that regard, and we're paying the wages of those sins. But is there a way to get that back? I think there is. For example, President Biden has talked about reshoring. What does that mean? It means taking all of those industries that we exported, that we built the supply lines in other countries, bring them home to the extent that we can do that feasibly. So we're going to start building chip factories here. We're going to start manufacturing goods that we need right here. And so as we do that, we're going to lift the income levels of the American people and protect our national security, because we have become over-reliant upon those supply lines, which we see have been choked off because of COVID and other real external matters, war in Ukraine, and other matters that are taking place. So we have, you know, globalization served a very good purpose, but it also exposed the vulnerability that the more distant your supply lines are, the greater the fragility of those the supply lines. And any interruption, you can see the consequence. For example, I lost my freezer, my refrigerator. I ordered it 11 months ago, and it hasn't come yet. And they say, well, supply line problems. And so that's where we have to start focusing. We'll talk about rare earth minerals. 90%, 92% are in China. We have them here. But we've said it's easier and dirtier. Mining is not a clean industry, so it produces a lot of complications. Can we do it here? The answer is yes, but we have very stringent environmental standards that we want to insist that we comply with, because we have global warming. So it gets very complicated. But I think the standard now is, it started under President Trump. We give him credit for that, saying, I want America first. And America first, unfortunately, it was a slogan back during prior to World War II,
right,
which produced some real divisions in this country. But putting the American people first doesn't mean you put us alone. So what Joe Biden did, and he's an Atlanticist, an internationalist, and saying we need allies. We need allies, and it's like you need friends. You can't do it. No man is an island unto himself, no man or woman. Same for no state and no country. You need to have friends throughout the world, and it's best to nurture those relationships and not allow them to become fragmented or broken, or accuse other countries of insidious acts against you. So when President Trump was railing against the Europeans and NATO being obsolete, a lot of us said, wait a minute, we need NATO. We need friends. We need the Indo-Pacific region to be friendly to us, because you have the greatest populations in trade taking place in the Indo-Pacific region. Anyway, I think what President Biden is doing, and I would hope if the Republicans take over in the next election, that the next Republican president would not adopt the notion that we don't need allies. Jim Mattis, General Mattis, I have a conflict of interest here because he's part of my firm. But General Mattis, one of the reasons he resigned, and as I like to say, Marines don't resign. There is nothing they won't challenge. And for him, a four-star general, whom I knew when I was at the Pentagon, and I've nurtured that friendship for many, many years, no Marine ever quits, and yet he quit the administration because he felt that his worldview was inconsistent with that of President Trump, because he felt that we needed to hold on to these allies. We needed to bring people closer to us. And he felt that that was being undermined, particularly as it pertains to the Middle East and pertains to Syria. When the former president said, let's pull out of Syria, and he meant immediately. And Jim Mattis said, well, can't we do this over a period of time? So we've got allies. You can't just walk away. We've got allies who have soldiers on the ground who are fighting and dying over there with us. And so it became an issue for him, saying, I can't do this. I can't carry out your orders, Mr. President, because it's inconsistent with my fundamental values here. So my hope is that we rebuild the industrial capacity, and there's going to be more informational-based capacity, because that's the age in which we live in, but we rebuild it here and strengthen it at the same time, keep those relationships very close to us, because we're going to need them going forward. China is a competitor. India will be competing at various levels with us, although they're a strategic partner as such, as the largest democracy in the world. So we need to nurture that relationship. We need to nurture all of those in South Korea, in Japan, in Singapore, in all of the Asia-Pacific countries, so-called ASEAN countries. So we need to build that. And, of course, we've got our neighbors, Canada and Mexico. So you have to do both. And my hope is that this boil will be lanced in the very near future. And I think Joe Biden said, you know, he wants to bring America back. And he declared this, America is back. And that really resonated with our allies. And the only hesitancy they had, they said, for how long are you back? How long will you carry out this policy, which we embrace, because that has been your policy since the end of World War II. And, you know, I think we made a good start on it. I think we got some real challenges coming up militarily, to be sure. Russia is going to remain a problem for us for the long term. It's not going away. China's not going away. So we have to figure out ways in which we can actually find areas of cooperation with China. I have been associated with a group that's organized to try to find two or three areas that we can say we can agree on, because we're going to disagree a lot with China, and should, in terms of military relations, because they are becoming a military power regionally, and their goal is to become a military power globally. So we're going to have a challenge there militarily on Taiwan, South China Sea, etc. So we've got to be able to deal with them on those issues. At the same time, say, are we both concerned about food security? Are we concerned about water security? Because what's happening is we are draining the water supplies, the global water supplies. And so we're going to have about a 40% shortage by within the next 10 years, the world will be 40% short of the water needs that we need. And we're seeing this taking place here, Colorado River, other parts of the West drying up. We're seeing it in the Middle East, seeing it certainly in China and India. So, you know, are there areas that we can cooperate? Food security, water security, energy security, and most importantly, perhaps, is pandemic security. Look at what's taking place in China today with their zero tolerance policy. And so it's resulting in massive unrest. And so there's a way, you know, they could have used something called Pfizer or Moderna or any of the other drugs that have been widely successful and chose not to. So is there an area going forward, because we're always going to have these issues, there are always a threat of some new virus developing or modifying itself. So those are areas that we could cooperate on and say, let's try reviewing what we can take off in the way of tariffs on agricultural goods, because who got hurt? We imposed tariffs on agriculture, and our farmers got hurt. We had to supply billions of dollars to help keep them going. So China needs our food. Our farmers need to sell their product, and there should be an area where we could say, let's find a way to agree on that issue. And we've seen what happened when the Russians were threatening to prevent Ukraine from exporting any of its grain. Who was getting hit by that? The African nations, who are impoverished. So the world's a pretty small place, and we're seeing more and more countries occupy a bigger role on the world stage, and we just have to really work hard at diplomacy, backed up by a strong military capability, backed up by some consensus here at home. Because if we don't develop a consensus of saying, okay, I can disagree with a democratic philosophy or programs, but maybe I can modify it in a way that makes sense to me. And the same is true of the Democrats, not seeing Republicans as simply concerned about making money and restricting rights, but saying maybe Republicans have a good idea about fiscal responsibility. So we have to try to find a way that we can develop a working majority that builds this consensus, because other countries are looking at the fault lines. They look at our racial divide here in this country, as has always been there, racial, ethnic, religious, economic, and they are looking to exploit those divisions, because the easiest thing for the Russians or anybody else to do is to simply send bots over here, which are malicious, which are capable of interrupting our infrastructure and the flow of data, et cetera. How do we exploit the racial divisions in the United States? And so we have to come to a resolution saying, look, we're going to work to reduce those tensions. We're going to work on these issues to say that we are the United States. It's always been a dream. It's never been quite the reality. But that's been the dream of this country, is that we are the most one of the most diverse in the world, and we use that diversity as a strength. And we have seen that all of the innovation, creativity that comes when people are free to express themselves, their art, their science, their economic brilliance, etc. Anyway, I'm taking a long time to go through this with you, Rich, but I have the opportunity in these advancing years to look back at where we have been as a country, and I think where we need to go.
Well, I appreciate it. I always love to get your insight, and you give me hope that we can find a pathway back to collaboration and getting back to the future, I guess we'd say.
Well, you know, Maine has been fortunate. You've got Susan Collins in the Senate. You've got Angus King in the Senate. You've got Jared Golden, a personal friend of mine, whom I admire, and others. So, I think Maine has always been, you know, dirigo, I lead. Maine loves the I lead part, and I think we have been able to do that with, I mentioned Margaret Chase Smith, Ed Muskie, George Mitchell, Olympia, Snow, and Jock. I mean, you go through the list, and we've done pretty well for a small state.
Absolutely, and you're a big part of that, too. It's wonderful to have the chance to talk with you again. Bill, I wish you and your family very happy holidays, and hope we all have a better new year. And thank you, as always, for making some time for us.
Rich, anytime, and thanks for asking me. I really appreciate it.